Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
What is an apology? When someone has been wronged or crossed, there's a sequence of events and emotions that occur before healing can ever be imagined. These might differ for some people, or the order might vary slightly, but first there's the actual offense, which invariably brings feelings of hurt, shame, inadequacy, humiliation, confusion. The list goes on and on.
At age 5, I was kidnapped by terror in a gunboat. It was a RCMP boat with a gun mounted on it to gather children from villages.
When I first got to school in Cranbrook, we were all given a number. My underwear, my socks, my uniform, everything that I had had a number. All the girls had their own numbers. And if you were caught with somebody else's number, you got whipped for that.
If you were caught reading any kind of a book or a magazine, you were punished. It was severe punishment that way.
The children who sang their songs and spoke their language were punished constantly for any little thing, for even for laughing.
And we couldn't even hug our own brothers. We couldn't even hold them and tell them we loved them. It took me a lot of years before I was able to tell my boys I loved them.
You know, I lost my childhood when I first got there and never knew what it was like to have parents. I never knew my mother, still don't today.
It was in the Indian Act. The cops came there and they were going to take us, or she'd go to jail, be fined, or all three.
And it's a document that every Native parent had to sign or they'd go to jail. And what it did was it actually surrendered guardianship rights to the principal of the residential school. So what this did is you had to sign away the guardianship power of your own child to the clergyman who ran the residential school. And at that point, the principal of that school then became the legal guardian of the kids. So that explains why these things could happen, how it could happen.
And it did have a severe negative effect on me, because for the longest time, I didn't feel like I was as good as other people. I actually really thought there was something wrong with me. I felt like I was inadequate, that I was less of a person.
On these shores, where the water laps against the rocks day in, day out, and across the vast expanse that is the rest of our great country, is a history of hate and fear that most of us don't even know about. Starting in the late 1800s and lasting all the way until the mid-1980s, the Canadian government teamed up with the Christian Church and made a law that forced Native parents to give up their children. The children were taken from their parents and forced to attend boarding schools throughout the country. The parents had no right to resist, and if they did, they were jailed. Some of the parents didn't even know where their babies were being taken.
Margaret Douglas, St. Paul's School in North Vancouver. The register of my paper, they put me down as 1928 when I must arrive there. My grandmother landed in the hospital. She had pneumonia, I guess. So I had to go along. They had to take me along with her in St. Paul's Hospital. I slept on the floor. But the next day, they weren't allowed to keep me because I wasn't sick. So they called the Indian policeman for the natives. And my grandmother explained to me where they were going to take me. Fine, I accepted that because my grandmother spoke in Squamish language. It's all I could understand at the time.
I'm sorry. It's okay.
Anyway, the policeman, the Indian policeman, who was a white man, but he was a policeman for the reserves, took me to the school in North Vancouver, St. Paul's School. I didn't even know at the time. He rang the bell. Then it was open, and I seen this person or whatever it was. I thought it was some kind of animal, all black and white. I was deadly scared of that, of the looks of it, of the person. I hung on to that policeman leg, and I wouldn't let him go. He had to drag me in to the pilot, and I wouldn't let go. It felt so strange at the time. He couldn't release me. So finally they had got somebody else. Find out who knew me, and it was Stella Newman. Well, Stella Lewis then. She's Mrs. Newman now. She came and spoke to me in our native tongue and explained that it was a school and whatnot. Yeah. So I accepted that, but I was deadly scared. And it was a lonely life for me there, because I wasn't allowed to see my family for about 3 years. I knew they were there because sister would give me something. Said it was from so-and-so, from my grandparents. Because they had to break that language out of me. We had to stay in that school all those years, summer holidays and all. We couldn't even go home. My grandmother asked permission through another party, because they lived up Squamish then. It was hard to get going back and forth then, no transportation. Asked the Lewis family for me to go, if I could go home. The nuns refused it completely. So that was just a lonely life for me.
Consecutive generations of children were taken to residential schools to endure the same abuses that their parents and grandparents had to live through. Substandard living conditions, inadequate food and clothing, combined with an explicit lack of emotional nourishment, made life for Native children a living hell in a supposed place of God. It's not hard to see how a steady stream of defective parenting skills cut through the foundations of a family tree, like a waterfall pounding deeper and deeper into the rock surface below it. Sandra Nahaney is the daughter of Margaret Douglas and had to survive much of the same torment throughout her experience in residential schools.
I didn't receive any nurturing or guidance or anything in school. It was a cold place for sisters and that were supposed to be taking care of children and guiding them and supervising them. It was very cold. Everything was regimental. It was like pray in the morning when you got out of bed, pray before you had breakfast, after you had breakfast, before you started school, after school, before lunch, after lunch, before you went to bed. My younger sister Brenda went there for a short period of time where she almost died because lack of medical attention. I can remember when I got old enough to do some work in the dining room to help do odd jobs. Then we'd go upstairs where the sisters and the brothers' dining room table was, and they had like beautiful fruits and vegetables, bananas, oranges, pastries, and down where we were eating, it was just more or less food that was not very, very good. I didn't stay there as long enough to have a great effect on me as other children. I never suffered any sexual abuse, but emotional and a lack of attention when you're a child can be just as bad. Yes, because I mean, when you're a child, you expect adults to take care of you and to nurture you and to guide you in a positive direction.
I was being punished for things I'd never done.
I forgot how old I was, either 6, 7, or 8. But I remember he took each of us in there one by one, and he had us bend over and had Vaseline with him. He did that to each of us 3 times, I remember that, to satisfy himself on little kids.
There was other times where they put us in a tub, and then they had a bucket of snakes, you know, them black and yellow snakes, and they'd throw that in the tub while we were having a bath.
I had problems with wetting the bed, and they would tie me in bed and put an electric underneath my sheet so that when I did wet, I would electrocute myself.
He electrocuted his penis there till my brother passed out. And he was laughing, brother. My brother said he was laughing while he was doing it.
You know, people were describing children being sterilized, being murdered, being used in medical experiments, being deliberately exposed to tuberculosis and then left to die.
They had put needles in my head and had hooked them up electrically and would zap me.
I've gone through so much loneliness all my life. And I'm still lonely yet. Because I don't know. They stripped me out of all my language, my family.
sorry.
You think I'd be over it? It still bothers me. I try to break away from it, thinking, well, that's long, long time ago. But it still hurts. Because I feel so lost and lonely. And I think my schoolmate, Marty, she felt the same way too. Because she wanted to burn that school down. She had all this paper and the matches in the kitchen area down on, you know. She tried to light the matches, tried to set fire to the paper. It would just blow out. Anyway, I walked away. I didn't want to be involved in that.
Mr. Speaker, I stand before you today to offer an apology to former students of Indian residential schools. The treatment of children in Indian residential schools is a sad chapter in our history. In the 1870s, the federal government, partly in order to meet its obligations to educate Aboriginal children, began to play a role in the development and administration of these schools. Two primary objectives of the residential school system were to remove and isolate children from the influence of their home, families, traditions, and cultures, and to assimilate them into the dominant culture. These objectives were based on the assumption that Aboriginal cultures and spiritual beliefs were inferior and unequal. Indeed, some saw it, as was infamously said, to kill the Indian in the child. Today we recognize that this policy of assimilation was wrong, has caused great harm, and has no place in our country.
And that was great that an apology was given, but these people that are given the apology, I don't know if they really feel that sincere, because it was not really themselves personally that inflicted that on us. You know, it was great that they did give the apology, but it really had no effect on me whatsoever. It didn't turn me on at all, because I don't know, it didn't affect me one way or the other.
If the government of Canada is going to issue an apology on residential schools and the policy of residential schools, it has to be sincere.
Well, I mean, even on the level of words, it didn't really go very far. It was a general acknowledgement that people suffered. It talked, as far as Stephen Harper went, was to refer to the fact that children were taken out of their homes. Some of the other party members, or party leaders, like Gilles Duceppe in particular, he did mention that children had died, and in fact he made reference in his speech to mass graves across the country. So what was interesting was the whole issue was talked around, and what was really blatant was the fact that there was no program of action accompanying it. It simply said, well, these unmentioned things happen, and it's too bad, but basically we're not going to hold anybody accountable. There was no indication of whether the churches that largely committed these crimes were ever going to face any kind of accountability or even a trial for what had gone on. There was no including of the people who had suffered in the schools. any of their offspring, the grandchildren, the children, none of them were included in the compensation package. And in fact, over half the people who went through residential schools have been disqualified from receiving any compensation because of a very, they have a point system whereby you have to prove that you suffered a certain amount of atrocities in order to get the piddly amount of money they're going to drop your way. So, I mean, all of that indicates not a government that's very apologetic, not a government or a system that really wants to look at what happened and hold the people responsible.
Kevin Annett is a former minister of the United Church who took it upon himself to give a voice to the native people who had suffered. For his efforts, the church exiled him and sabotaged his life. He continued to expose Canada's ugly secret by writing a book and filming a documentary about the genocide of our native people entitled Unrepentant. Apart from actually being at the schools, he is closer to this topic than anybody.
Well, the residential schools were a church idea in the first place. In the early to mid-1800s, they started up. They've eventually got government sanction in the late 1800s. But time and again, it's interesting, looking in the documents I found in the UBC library over the last 12 years, time and again you see letters from Indian agents saying, you know, these residential schools are not a good thing. They're breaking up families. They're causing long-term social problems, family discord, all sorts of things that are going to be bad that we're going to have to deal with. And the churches would intervene and say, no, you can't close the residential schools, you know. We've got to give these kids a good Christian education, which was their justification for the fact that they were making a lot of money out of these kids. They were getting per capita grants every year for each child. They would often not report children who died so they could continue to get the money. That's been documented a lot. And they set a lot of these residential schools set on very valuable resources in the fisheries and the minerals and the timber out here in BC especially. So there was a real economic motive in keeping these things going, and it was the churches that were the main force in keeping them going. So, you know, in any court case, any fair system of justice would hold the churches about 80 to 90% accountable. You know, the government was definitely criminally negligent in not, you know, monitoring the schools better, in turning a blind eye and whitewashing a lot of the things they were hearing. But it, you know, it was nuns and priests and church officials on the ground committing these crimes. The churches were the ones that backed the introduction of the early sterilization laws in the 1920s that said any native person could be sterilized at the decision of the principal of the residential school. So, I mean, all of that is a crime of genocide. You're trying to wipe out people. Canada has yet to take that seriously. So in that sense, the apology is a big evasion of responsibility. An apology can be an admission of regret, okay? But it also can be a way of absolving yourself. Like in the Middle Ages, they would write these letters called apologetics, where you would defend somebody, you would defend a position. And so an apology in the English language has a hidden meaning, not so obvious, and it really means it's a way of saying, yes, something bad happened, but I can't be held responsible for it. And that's exactly the tone of what the apology was. That is, it was a way for the government to say, we're not accountable. And they proved that by the fact of not showing anything they were going to do, of allowing the churches to get away with murder. You know, an example of that is last February, Bob Watts, who was head of their government's so-called Truth and Reconciliation Commission, said that, yes, criminal acts occurred in the residential schools, referring to homicides and murders, but there'll be no criminal investigation, which is like an amazing thing to say. It's like saying, yeah, we know Clifford Olson killed all these children, but he's not going to go to trial for it. That's what's happened in a big way in Canada. As soon as he made that statement, all of the churches said, yeah, we'll work with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Naturally, because they've been told that they're never going to be prosecuted for these things. You know, this Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is part of the apology, you're not allowed, if you're a Native person, you go to these things, you can't name a name of a perpetrator. You can't. They cannot take evidence of anything referring to wrongdoing in residential schools. Well, if they can't hear any evidence of wrongdoing, then what is the purpose of this hearing? It's a kind of an official whitewash. It's allow certain information to get in, but not anything that's going to implicate anybody. And that the apology and the TRC are just part of the same thing. It's a way of protecting the perpetrator. We had TVs set up in the downtown east side, some of the community centers, so people could watch. And that's where I saw it. And also I got a transcript sent from Ottawa after of it. But I noticed, you know, a lot of the survivors downtown very upset when they watched it. You know, the best they said about it is, well, at least some things are being acknowledged finally. But it's kind of like just this, you know, it caused a lot of pain in people because their lives and their wounds are being opened again. But then what? Okay, I'm sorry. What does that mean? In a lot of the West Coast native languages, there's not even a word for I'm sorry. An apology isn't a verbal thing in their cultures. It's something you do in practice. You know, you set something right by doing something, not by talking about it. So it's a foreign concept to a lot of people. I mean, what is it, frankly, going to do for somebody whose life has been destroyed to hear I'm sorry? I mean, it's almost an insult. I mean, if it happened to me, I'd be insulted if somebody said I'm sorry to me. I'd say, okay, if you're really sorry, who's the person who did it? Surrender the perpetrators. Tell us where the children are buried. Let's have memorial sites with the names of these kids. Let's have the churches go to jail, these church officials who planned it. I mean, that would be a genuine apology, not a bunch of words in Parliament.
He said, you know what, sis? He says, I can't wait to get out of this hellhole. I'm going to tell everything. And then the phone went dead. People at resident at Cooper Island always listened to our phone calls and censored our letters back, you know, coming in and going out. So I, you know, like I was afraid for him.
One particular incident was where nuns sexually abused a young boy, and as a result, the nun became pregnant and gave birth to a baby. And after it gave birth to the baby, this was one incident that they killed the baby, and they had the young fella dig a grave for the baby.
It was a short interview with a woman called Irene Favel, who was interviewed on the CBC. She described seeing a little baby thrown into a furnace in the 1940s in Saskatchewan, a Catholic residential school. This was a live child who had been born as a result of rape, a priest raping a young girl, and they killed this little child. Well, I mean, why isn't that a subject of a criminal investigation in Canada?
The only thing the church did to me was say, I'm sorry, wrote a letter of apology. Some bitch thinks writing on paper and saying verbally to me, saying I'm sorry, doesn't work. It makes me more angrier. Do you think they can give me a few dollars and that'll make me forget?
Every week there's people who die. Either they get their money and they go overdose on drugs, or they kill themselves out of grief because of things that happen. I often know, working with Native people who've been through these death camps called residential schools, for them, they never talk about money. They never talk about compensation. You know, a lot of the Native politicians will talk about that. But the people on the ground, they keep saying over and over, I just want to face the people who did this to me. I want to tell them what I think about them, and I want them to admit what they did to me in front of the world.
Yeah, I think if they did that, I would forgive them. If they would just admit what they did to us is genocide.
Three categories of genocide: cultural, physical, and biological. And that ran the gamut of everything from denying people the right to speak their language, denying children the right to just mix together boys and girls on a normal basis, to everything right up to sterilization, things designed to prevent births so that the people die off. And in fact, all of those things described by the UN Convention on Genocide happened in residential schools. It's been documented now.
What is an apology? Is it recognition? Is it bringing justice? Is it being held accountable? And once an attempt is made, what comes next? Thank you.
Attention, woman and